loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, news broke today that prosecutors in New York charged Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya with obstruction of justice. But a closer look at the indictment reveals that U.S. authorities charged her essentially for corresponding with Russian prosecutors to advocate for her client, the corporation Prevazon. Nevertheless, the indictment is now being cited as evidence that Veselnitskaya is an agent of the Russian government and was acting as such when she participated in the June 2016 Trump Tower meeting prior to the election. Next, today we begin our new regular segment, which we'll do every Tuesday, called Women and Society with Dr. Hannah Dickinson. In this weekly segment, we talk about the major issues, challenges, and struggles facing women in all aspects of society. Then, U.S.-China trade talks showed signs of progress today with President Trump tweeting optimistically that a deal is likely. Tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese imports are set to jump from 10% to 25% on March 2nd if there's no deal. Meanwhile, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is in Beijing for talks with Chinese Premier Xi Jinping for the fourth time since assuming power. And then, Turkish President Erdogan issued a blunt put-down of National Security Advisor John Bolton yesterday over his pledge to ensure Turkish non-aggression against Syrian Kurdish forces, saying, "We cannot accept Bolton's messages given from Israel," and adding, "Bolton has made a serious mistake." Bolton was in Turkey yesterday, but Erdogan refused to meet him. And finally, the French government will take new measures as it seeks to corral the Yellow Vest movement after another weekend of mass protests. More than 50,000 people demonstrated over the weekend, and the Macron government is taking full advantage of the opportunity to clamp down on dissent. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to breaking news. Prosecutors in New York today charged Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya with obstruction of justice. But a closer look at the indictment reveals that U.S. authorities charged her essentially for corresponding with Russian prosecutors to advocate for her client, the corporation Prevazon. Nevertheless, the indictment is now being cited as evidence that Veselnitskaya is an agent of the Russian government and was acting as such when she participated in the June 2016 Trump Tower meeting prior to the election. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. And we're joined in studio by our own Lee Stranahan. He's the co-host of the Radio Sputnik show Fault Lines. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks for having me.
Jim, this is an unusually and I think unnecessarily complicated case. Can you tell us in plain English what happened today?
No, it's very, you got to get into the weeds of this whole story with Browder and Magnitsky. Essentially, this woman is being charged in an American court for activities representing her client in Russia. And it all stems from a tax fraud case in Russia that somehow the Southern District of New York decided to get involved in. And it's very strange. But essentially what they're saying is that she participated with Russian attorneys, state attorneys, to draft a memorandum that was then brought into the court in the United States. And she misrepresented her role in that to the American court. Now, this is a case that has been settled a year and a half ago. And there's no reason to be bringing these charges. This is what lawyers do all the time. They talk to each other. They help each other formulate positions. She was formulating position with sometimes they do it with opposing counsel. She was doing it with someone who was on her same side, essentially. There's nothing here except the desire to get headlines. And I want to tell you, the headline in the Times is very interesting. Veselnitskaya, Russian in Trump Tower meeting, is charged in case that shows Kremlin ties. Now, 99% of the people who read that are going to say they showed the Kremlin ties about the Trump Tower meeting. They showed Kremlin ties with Trump. You got to read through it. What it's saying is they showed she had Kremlin ties. It's really just to generate this idea, again, that there's some kind of groundswell of evidence that's going to prove some kind of collusion with Russia that doesn't exist. And in the course, it's all this Browder stuff is really, I have gotten into it. It drives you crazy because it's infuriating. And both the Times and the Post repeat flat out lies about this situation. They both say that Magnitsky was a Russian lawyer working for Browder. He wasn't a lawyer, and that he exposed this fraud, and he didn't expose the fraud. He was part of it. But you got to get into the weeds to know this. So really, it's quite complicated. And when you look at the specific charge, it's one of these cross the street against the red light things in the context of lawyering. And they bring it up a year and a half after the case has been settled.
Lee, you've gotten down into the weeds on this case, especially where it has to do with the Magnitsky Act. And what can you tell us about this?
Okay, so everything Jim is saying is true and correct, but let me add some dimension to it. Jim is absolutely correct. That's the way the Times is pitching it. But what people need to understand is propaganda in this country operates on the left and the right. So if you're on the left, which New York Times, you think this proves Russian collusion. How's this being pitched on Fox News? How's this being pitched by people on the right? It's being pitched to show that Natalia Veselnitskaya set up Don Jr. You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
And that the Kremlin ties prove that Putin's behind it. Now, by the way, in both of these scenarios, the left and the right, Vladimir Putin is the unquestioned evildoer.
He's the puppet master.
That's right. And Natalia Veselnitskaya is his pawn who's being used for either this collusion or this frame-up. Now, the fact is, as Jim knows, because Jim obviously knows this case, what's going on here is a PR thing by Bill Browder. Bill Browder is at the center of this. He is a proven liar. I posted his entire 2015 deposition on YouTube. It's 6.5 hours. Anybody can watch it and see that the guy's public story doesn't match what he says under oath in 2015. Now, the reason they settled this case is Browder was going to be forced to testify.
This case was settled in May 2017. So that's 18 months ago. The case been settled. And it was a kind of a surprise settlement in one way, because Browder had convinced his friend, U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara in the Southern District in New York. They got together and it was based on Browder's testimony that these charges were made.
That's right. The whole story was Browder literally walking into the office and saying, here's what the story is, with no proof. They didn't investigate it. They took Browder at his word. And Browder in his deposition admits that he has no idea where the paperwork that proves his case comes from. He has no idea where it's gone from. And furthermore, let me point one other thing. This case was brought in part because Natalia Veselnitskaya's emails were hacked, and that material was released by the organization run by Russian billionaire in exile, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who supports Browder, who backs Browder. So it's important to understand that the hacked documents here, they didn't come out of nowhere. They came from one of Bill Browder's chief allies and lobbyist sponsors, the guy who paid for the Magnitsky Act, Khodorkovsky. So
the Southern District Court of New York, the prosecutors, made a request to the Russian prosecutor, a criminal referral, asking that this company, Prevazon, that they have their financial records, their communications turned over. The Russian prosecutor goes to the lawyers for Prevazon. That's this now indicted woman. They ask, well, what's your story? And she gives them a response. She says, no, we shouldn't be forced to turn over our financial records. In fact, we are not even the targets of the Magnitsky Act. It's just that our assets in New York, our real estate assets were seized. You shouldn't go along with the request from the Southern District Court prosecutor in New York. And finally, the Russian prosecutor says, you know what? We agree with her. We agree with Prevazon, and we're not going to require and compel them to turn over their records, right? That's what happened.
And the Russian prosecutor produced a document demonstrating the case that they got the wrong defendants.
See, so where's the obstruction of justice?
So
I'm not getting it.
If you're a legal entity, a judge or a prosecutor, you go to investigate. So you get the story from the defendant, you get the story from the plaintiff, you make a determination. And now what this indictment is basically saying is that the Russian prosecutor agreed with her. And because they agreed with her, and then she went back to the same U.S. District Court and said the Russian prosecutor stated that we were right. And they said, well, you didn't tell us that you provided information to the Russian prosecutor. How else would the Russian prosecutor come to any determination if they don't do an investigation asking for information from both sides?
Because there's a criminal case against Bill Browder. There's a criminal, he's been convicted, but there's more criminal charges against him. And it makes perfect sense for her working on the civil action where Browder testified under oath to talk to the prosecutor. It makes perfect sense. There's nothing weird about it.
Now, this woman has been thoroughly demonized.
Oh, yes.
She has been thoroughly demonized as the Kremlin agent. Again, she met with Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort in June 2016. She was there representing her client. She's against the Magnitsky Act, this sanctioning law that the U.S. uses against everybody right now. Lee Stranahan, you and Garland Nixon on the show Fault Lines here on Radio Sputnik, you interviewed her on April 6, 2018. I want to play a short audio clip. We have a voiceover. She gave the interview in Russian, but let's just hear her voice because you never hear her voice.
Never.
She's just demonized. That's the whole process of demonization. Let's listen.
The fact that my position was taken by Russian law enforcement authorities does not make me the Kremlin's lawyer. The fact alone that I was communicating some information to the General Prosecutor's Office of the Russian Federation does not make me its lawyer in the least. I am acting as a source of information for Russian law enforcement. And I shared this very information with U.S. authorities as well. I was also willing to share this information with Congress, but I didn't get a chance.
Wow, Jim Kavanaugh, she was willing to talk to Congress too, but she didn't get a chance.
That's what the Trump Tower meeting was about. She was naively saying, if I get to the right people and I'm able to talk to them, I'll show them that Browder's a liar and a fraud. Of course, that was never going to happen, and nobody cares what the truth is about this. You know, Browder was a great vehicle for Russophobia. So that's what the Trump Tower meeting was about. And it's really just kind of, and what Lee said is also interesting, because what they're getting her on specifically in this is that they got hacked emails from her and Word documents that they had the metadata to, showing drafts that were passed back and forth between her and a Russian prosecutor, not necessarily the office of the prosecutor, showing edits that she made and that he made and that they suggested to each other. And then they're saying, oh, she misled the court about her role in drafting those. She actually drafted those documents. Well, you know, again, this is what lawyers do. They help each other out. They say, well, what do you think we should say? Is this true or not true? And she'll write back and make an edit and say, no, this is the way it actually happened. And he'll either accept it or won't accept it. But somebody hacked the emails. That's a very good point that Lee made, because they got the emails and the Word documents attached with all the metadata. And that's what they're hanging her on, this one little thing. You misrepresented your role in drafting these documents.
We have 30 seconds left. Lee, what's the real point of this indictment a year and a half after the case is settled? Who's the real target?
It's propaganda. The target is people on the left and on the right who are susceptible to this. But I will tell you this, from interviewing Natalia Veselnitskaya, she's very smart, she's very competent, and I would not be shocked if she fights this, and that will be their worst nightmare, because more and more people are figuring out that Bill Browder is a proven liar and that this whole thing was a setup. We see it all the time on my show. More people are figuring this out. This could be a very bad move on the Southern District's part.
We will watch this very, very closely, and we will leave it there. We were joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net, and we were joined here in the studio by Lee Stranahan, the co-host of the Radio Sputnik show Fault Lines. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we begin a new regular segment, which we'll do every Tuesday, called Women in Society with Dr. Hannah Dickinson. In this weekly segment, we talk about the major issues, challenges, and struggles facing women in all aspects of society. Hannah Dickinson is a professor, and she's an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. Professor Dickinson will be joining us every week from Geneva, New York, but this week she joins us from London. Welcome.
Thank you so much, John. I'm really happy to be starting this new segment with you all.
We are very pleased with you doing this new segment, and we'd like to start with a major issue. This is something that's been covered in the major print media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and that is that despite the fact that abortion is legal in the United States, it's very, very difficult to access in many states. And in fact, according to the Washington Post, a medical student wanted to learn how to perform an abortion, and really not even to perform an actual surgical abortion. She wanted to learn how to prescribe the morning after pill, and she was denied permission. Beyond that, she was actually, what was it, Brian, forbidden from participating in the graduation exercises or some such nonsense like that. It just goes to show you what so many physicians in this country are up against. Can you comment on that?
I think this article by Stephanie Ho, who's now the director for primary care, Planned Parenthood in Great Plains, is really important for anyone who cares about reproductive justice in America, right? We know that there's been a long time war on abortion providers. And so her piece highlights the impact this war has had on medical education and ultimately the availability of trained abortion providers in the U.S. So if we think about all of the barriers that women experience in receiving the healthcare they choose, and sometimes for medical reasons they need. This emphasis on the physician is really important, right? We know that abortion providers face struggles to find employment. They have significantly higher malpractice insurance, that they face risks to their and their patients' lives from vigilantes, that they have to deal with regressive policies like waiting periods and the requirement to distribute anti-abortion literature in some states. And now Stephanie Ho is pointing out the ways that on top of all of that, medical students are struggling to receive the training they need to conduct what's actually a very simple medical procedure.
Yeah, I can remember. I'm from Western New York, and of course, a doctor, Hannah Dickinson, is also in Geneva, New York, a western part of New York. 20 years ago in October 25th, 1998, Dr. Barnett Slepian, who provided abortions in Buffalo, New York, was gunned down, murdered at his home. It's been a war against women and a war against those doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals who dare to provide women with the legal right to abortion. I mean, again, it's been a reign of terror. And when you think about it, Hannah, here you have mainly male political assemblies like state legislatures or mainly male-dominated judicial systems like judges deciding whether or not women can control or have the right to control their own bodies, which, of course, first and foremost, is the right to have or not to have children. I mean, when you think about it, it seems like the United States, even though it says it's against religious theocratic connections between the church and state, it's against, say, the ideology or theology of ISIS. In many ways, the U.S. government, through these state legislative actions and through the courts, is doing the same thing.
That's exactly right, Brian. And again, I think this article points to the ways in which now, on top of legislatures, on top of, right, we're seeing pregnant women being tried, right? So now we're seeing the impact of the criminal justice system on women's health. And now we have a sort of third example of another space, the hospital and the medical training hospital, where women's rights are being curtailed. You know, 55% of medical schools report that they offer students no clinical exposure to abortion. And that's in part because of pressure from right-wing hospital donors who make it a condition of their funding that training hospitals offer no abortions at all. So it's not just the courts. It's not just the legislatures. Now it's our hospitals, too.
Yeah. Dr. Hannah Dickinson is our guest in this new weekly segment on Loud and Clear called Women and Society. Hannah, let's go on to the next story. Time is going fast.
It is indeed.
Let's talk about Tennessee and the clemency for Santoya Brown. Big, big story.
And let me add one thing, too. Big story and a shock to the courts in Tennessee that just recently had denied her clemency.
That's right. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a real victory for the grassroots activists that for a decade, 15 years actually, have been fighting for Santoya Brown's release. And the on-the-ground organizing for her and so many other incarcerated women is important and impressive work. But I also think it's important that we not forget two things, right? First, that Santoya Brown has been imprisoned for nearly half her life for an act of self-defense she committed as a minor. And second, that there are still thousands of women and non-binary people who are incarcerated because of acts of self-defense and or because of crimes they committed as minors. So this is an important victory, but I think important we don't forget the larger issue here.
Yeah, and again, let's go over Santoya Brown's story. She was 16 years old, meaning she's a minor. She was a child, forced into prostitution, and she killed a man, a 41-year-old man, who she said was trying to do her harm, and she was sentenced to life in prison. And even just recently, in spite of all of the grassroots movement, it was determined that she would have to serve 51 years before she would be eligible for parole. This freedom for Santoya Brown that's coming up in August, she will have a 10-year parole, but she's going to be out of prison. This is exclusively the consequence of grassroots activism. Go ahead.
That's right. The organizers in Tennessee, especially the Black Lives Matter movement there, as well as some really important work by Miriam Kaba to free Santoya, has brought important attention both to her case, but also all of the ways in which we can start to see a kind of abuse to prison pipeline for women, right? Between 71% and 95% of incarcerated women have experienced physical violence from an intimate partner. And women's vulnerability, especially when they're engaged in survival sex work, is an important part of that story. And these grassroots organizers have done really heroic work to bring attention to the important race and gender dimensions of the really unequal ways in which our criminal justice system punishes young people and people who have already been victims of crimes themselves.
Hannah, we have about 60 seconds left. Can you touch very, very quickly on the Yellow Vest movement in France? 50,000 people participated in demonstrations over the weekend. Many, many of those people were women, and they've been more and more active in the Yellow Vest protests to raise issues surrounding the plight of women in France. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so really important moment on Saturday. Women organized as a bloc in Paris and all over France to really do two things. First, to emphasize the ways that austerity measures are disproportionately impacting women, and to draw attention to the ways that the protests, both in their unfair characterizations as violent and the violence inflicted on protesters by police, go against their aims in this movement, which is really to bring attention to particularly the plight of single mothers, but in general, working class women throughout France who do the majority of the care work, both waged and unwaged throughout France.
Great. That was the voice of Dr. Hannah Dickinson. She's a professor and an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. Professor Dickinson will be joining us every week from Geneva, New York, to talk about women in society. But this week she joined us from London. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
U.S.-China trade talks showed signs of progress today, with President Trump tweeting optimistically that a deal is likely. Tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese imports are set to jump from 10% to 25% on March 2nd unless there is a deal. Meanwhile, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is in Beijing for talks with Chinese Premier Xi Jinping for the fourth time since assuming power. We'll discuss all of that with Andy Brennan. He is a journalist with Asia Times and CGTN. He joins us from Beijing, and we're joined from London by Jude Woodward. Jude is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. Jude, Andy, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Hi there.
Nice to be back.
Andy Brennan, let's start with you real quickly. We only have a limited amount of time, so we want to kind of go quickly here. You're there in Beijing. What's the mood about these trade talks?
Talking to fellow Chinese colleagues, they're actually all very, very tired of it, and they really wish for a positive outcome to occur, though they don't hold out any hope. There's actually a lot of mistrust, especially because they think the Americans keep changing the game. The difference between the public opinion and the government opinion is obviously quite stark. The government has red lines. The public would, from speaking to a lot of people on the streets, would very happily have compromises such as allowing more access into China, what they see anyway, for American companies. But one thing I have heard from a few Chinese is that they would like the Americans to tone down and tone back their criticism of China. Whether that would happen or not, I'm not sure. But the the chances of that happening, I think, are slim to none. I don't think the trade talks are going to get very far. I would say the Chinese negotiators, which have included Liu He, who's the vice president, they're adept, they're clever, and they're going to probably offer the Americans this time round credible deal, but one that's going to be quite divisive and deliberately so to try and split Trump's cabinet. It might be quite palatable to people like, Steve Mnuchin, but it will not be palatable to people like Navarro or especially to Robert Lighthizer.
Before we go to Jude Woodward, just very briefly in the next 30 seconds or so, what would the Chinese be giving?
So they definitely offer maybe what the Japanese did kind of with the old playbook, because they know that the Americans are running the same playbook against the Japanese. They maybe offer to buy more resources from the United States. People are talking about the LNG, you know, liquefied natural gas, but, you know, to try and reduce the deficit. But anything above that, that's where it gets very difficult. Because of the emotive history on their psyche from the century of humiliation, there are red lines and things they just cannot back down on, more so from a historical and cultural perspective. And this is just going to drag on and, in fact, I think get worse.
Jude Woodward, Andy Brennan thinks things will get worse, not better, even though Trump had this optimistic tweet. What's your take?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I certainly think, well, what I would say is that I think the problem is in the U.S. China didn't start this trade war and has made it clear from the start that if it is a matter of reasonable concessions to get a quiet life, it's prepared to make them. For example, as Andy said, buying more LNG, buying more soybeans, buying a few more cars, making some contribution to reducing the trade deficit in those forms. But the trade deficit is not China's fault. It exists because of internal problems of the U.S. economy and the priorities of governments in terms of investment, etc. And Trump hasn't turned that around. Whether the trade war goes on, I think the problem is the economic situation in the U.S. is getting worse for Trump. And while that's not because of the trade war with China, it clearly contributes to it. I mean, when Trump did his tweet saying he was tariff man, the U.S. stock markets lost 1,000 points in a week. And he's used a very strong position on the U.S. stock markets as the prime indicator of his economic success, which was being completely knocked upside down over the last month. So I think the pressure on Trump to take steps to ameliorate the economic conditions in the U.S. are going to get stronger as the U.S. economy, most international commentators and U.S. economic commentators now accept that the U.S. is going to go into cyclical downturn in 2019-20. So the difficult economic situation, maybe Trump will feel he has to back off a bit from the trade war. We'll see.
That's the voice of Jude Woodward. We're talking to Jude from London. We're also talking with Andy Brennan from Beijing about the trade talks that have been going on yesterday and earlier today between the U.S. and China. Again, there is the upcoming March 1st deadline where a truce has been declared that was declared at the Buenos Aires G20 meeting. Xi Jinping met with Donald Trump. Andy Brennan, of course, on that very day that Xi Jinping was meeting with Trump, the United States government also had the Canadian government arrest the chief financial officer of Huawei, the major Chinese technology company in Vancouver, Canada. She is still in Canada. She's been finally released on bail, but she can't go anywhere. She's under house arrest. When you look at the big picture again, you can see that there is a big, big deterioration from, say, 5 years ago or even 3 years ago in U.S.-China relations. I'm looking at a Washington Post headline from today. Could a Chinese-made metro car spy on us? Many experts say yes. The metro is our subway here. And so the article is about how American transit systems that have been buying Chinese rail cars in order to use on their own metro or subway systems have to be on alert now because the Chinese could be rigging these cars for surveillance purposes. I mean, it really is outlandish. It made me think of Kim Il-sung's theory of Shushe, a self-reliance for North Korea. And I was wondering, well, maybe the U.S. will adopt this theory because the International Division of Labor being as it is, of course, the U.S. would have to import different parts and different commodities from other parts of the world. Anyway, the big picture is things have gone south for U.S.-China relations. At the same time, Andy, Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, has arrived in Beijing at this very moment by train for high-level talks, the fourth such talks between Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping. What do you make of that? And is his visit related in any way to the ongoing U.S.-China relationship? Is there a triangulation here?
So just very briefly on the article from the Washington Post, it sounds quite hysterical. It seems that this environment has really kicked off since the last election, and like security, you have to securitize everything. You have to be alert for everything. We're going to be attacked and hacked and interfered with. And it's politicizing China and as a great boogeyman like never before. When you think back that like relations were to the point where the Chinese did the hide your power and bide your time. Even during the Soviet times, China worked with the U.S. At times against the Soviets. Beijing even helped supply weapons to the Mujahideen and had listening posts in Dongbei and Xinjiang. And it's deteriorating rapidly with regards to, well, especially deteriorated from then, but with regards to the Kim visiting Beijing, the Chinese media, state media, never announce when he comes until he's officially here, though you will see on Weibo videos of him coming through Dongdang with his train. I would speculate that there is some sort of signal being sent, but whether the Chinese are using the North Koreans to send it to the Americans, I think it's more rather the other way around, perhaps, where Kim is happy and to visit Xi and wants to send a signal ahead of his potential visit to with Donald Trump that he can't be bullied. We have a strong protector. We have a strong backer. Your sanctions still aren't working. There is some definite work going on between the two nations. But it's a four-day visit, and it is strange that it's ahead of the rumors of a second planned U.S.-North Korea meeting. And there's been a real warming of relations. Like last year, Kim visited China three times, and before that, there was a six-year cooling. I think there is a signal being sent. Yonhap in South Korea reported that Xi and Kim spoke for an hour, but again, the Chinese media will not report on that, and they never really do.
Let's bring Jude Woodward in. Jude, we have about just over 60 seconds, about 90 seconds left. Again, what's your take on all of this, the triangulation? Obviously, the U.S.-DPRK relationship is important and in flux. U.S.-China relationship important and in flux. Go ahead. You take us out.
Well, I think the truth is that the U.S. is creating or attempting to create problems in the region that nobody wants. The China doesn't want problems with North Korea. Between the U.S. and North Korea, North Korea doesn't want the problems. South Korea doesn't want the problems. Even Japan doesn't particularly want the problems. But the three key players definitely don't want the problems, and they're being created by the U.S. And this has led to a stalling of the talks because the U.S. just makes demands and doesn't offer anything. I think what this demonstrates is that China and the DPRK are very closely coordinating their tactics and responses on this. And secondly, it just underlines the fact that increasingly in the region, there is a bit of a united front between the DPRK, China, but also South Korea on keeping the situation calm and allowing progress in relations, inter-regional relations of a trade, economic, transport, communications. This is all going on between all three of these countries. And all of them want this to continue. And the fly in the ointment is the U.S.
Yeah, I agree with you. The last time I was in DPRK was 5 years ago. At that time, relations with China were pretty cool. China relations between DPRK and South Korea were obviously not just cool, but downright frozen. Things have changed and changed dynamically. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been joined from Beijing by Andy Brennan. Andy is a journalist with Asia Times and CGTN. He joined us from Beijing, and we were joined from London by Jude Woodward. Jude is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Turkish President Erdogan issued a blunt put-down of National Security Advisor John Bolton yesterday over his pledge to ensure Turkish non-aggression against Syrian Kurds, saying, quote, "We cannot accept Bolton's message given from Israel," unquote, and adding, quote, "Bolton has made a serious mistake," unquote. Bolton was in Turkey yesterday, but Erdogan refused to meet with him. We're joined from Washington by Dr. Gernal Tol, the founding director of the Middle East Institute's Center for Turkish Studies. She's also a former professor and has taught courses on Islamist movements in Western Europe, Turkey, world politics, and the Middle East. Welcome back, Dr. Tol.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Tol, we seem to have a disconnect here in U.S. policy toward Turkey and Syria. You have President Trump tweeting one thing. You have National Security Advisor Bolton saying another thing in Turkey, and the Turks responding rather angrily. How do you see this problem?
That's right. There's a lot of confusion, and that confusion has angered Turks. Turkish officials are angry that National Security Advisor Bolton and top American military officials are slowing what President Trump suggested would be a quick exit from Syria. And there are other, of course, problems with John Bolton's statements for the Turks. He told reporters in Israel that the withdrawal would be based on conditions such as the protection of Kurdish allies who are considered to be linked to the terrorist organization. And another condition is the defeat of the Islamic State. And Bolton also talked about how the U.S. would want assurances about Israel's security, which means Americans would really want to curb Iranian power in Syria. So all those conditions mean that the process could take months, if not more than a year. So that's what has been frustrating Turks, because they were expecting a quick withdrawal, and they certainly were expecting an end to U.S. Kurdish partnership in Syria. But Bolton's statement suggests that that might not be the case.
President Erdogan had an op-ed in today's New York Times in which he says there will be no victory for the terrorists. Who are the terrorists in Erdogan's view?
Well, the Syrian Kurdish militia called the YPG, they have worked very closely with the U.S. and in fact become the ground force for U.S. operations against the Islamic State. And Turkey considers them as the sister organization of a Kurdish insurgency group called the PKK, and that is considered a terrorist organization by the United States, Turkey, and Europe. So the YPG, which is, again, the Syrian Kurdish militia, is considered a terrorist organization by the Turks.
What would you expect to happen then in the event of a U.S. withdrawal? What happens to the YPG?
I think the Kurds are now in a very difficult spot because they have worked very closely with the Americans in the past few years, since 2014, in the fight against the Islamic State. They have received not just military support, but diplomatic and political support. But on the other hand, that partnership angered not only the Turks, but also Russians, Iranians, and the regime. So that's why now they are in a very difficult position. If the U.S. withdraws from Syria completely, they will be in a very vulnerable situation because over the past few years, they managed to establish an autonomous region, and particularly the northeastern part of the country, which is under U.S. and YPG control, is rich in it's a region with rich oil resources. So if the U.S. withdraws from Syria completely, that means that the region might be captured by the regime forces with the help of Iranian and Russian forces. So now they are in a difficult spot, and they are trying to talk to the Russians and the regime. Right after the U.S. decision, Trump announcement to withdraw from Syria, Kurdish delegation was sent to Moscow to hold talks with the Russians. And they also, the Kurds, have been holding talks with the regime. So I guess now they are in a vulnerable situation, and they have to really accept whatever the Russians and the regime offer them in case of a complete U.S. withdrawal.
Follow-up question, and I want to talk about the trajectory of President Erdogan on the position on his position towards the Kurds. In 2013, there was a ceasefire declared by the Turkish government with the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers Party. There was a ceasefire, and it seemed as if it would be holding for a while. It did hold for a while. Why did it break apart? And what was Erdogan's responsibility, if you consider him to be a responsible party, in the breakup of that ceasefire?
Well, you're right. There was a peace process going on between the two parties, between Turkey and the PKK in 2013. And the reason, so to Erdogan's credit, it was Erdogan's decision to launch this peace process in an effort to resolve the Kurdish issue peacefully. And I think what was happening in Syria at the time prompted his decision, because after President Assad decided to use the Kurds as a trump card against Turkey, President Erdogan decided that he really needed to resolve his country's Kurdish problem. Otherwise, he would always remain vulnerable to Assad and others, other regional actors' policies, Kurdish policy. So that was the aim. That's why he launched the Kurdish opening in 2013. And according to the agreement, the PKK decided to withdraw from Turkish territories in return for Turkish government concessions, such as Turkish government would grant, would address some of the demands of the Kurds. And those demands included a new civic definition of citizenship in the Turkish constitution, and some form of decentralization, and a redefinition of anti-terrorism law in the constitution. So those were some of the demands. So the PKK started withdrawing after the deal, and yet the Turkish government did not hold up its end of the deal. And that's why the PKK stopped withdrawing. And yet, despite that, there was still a ceasefire until 2015. So the ceasefire fell apart after the parliamentary elections in Turkey in 2015. And in those elections, Erdogan's party lost the parliamentary majority. And just right after the election, several PKK members killed Turkish policemen. And Erdogan used that to restart the war. So I think at this point, if you ask me whose fault it was, I think both parties made wrong decisions. But domestically, I think the breakdown in the ceasefire really helped Erdogan consolidate his power. So in a way, this was his strategy, and it worked well. But now it's creating difficulty for him regionally. Domestically, he might be using this fight against the Kurd to his advantage. But regionally, I think Turkey's failure to resolve its Kurdish problem has strained Turkey's ties with the United States, has made Turkey very vulnerable vis-a-vis Russia, Iran, and the regime. So if you look at it from a foreign policy perspective particularly, I think that decision to end the ceasefire really worked to the disadvantage of Turkey, and I would say to the PKK.
I want to ask you, too, about broader Turkish relations in the region. Erdogan made a point of criticizing Israel vis-a-vis the Bolton visit. In years past, Turkey and Israel had very close relations. Those relations soured about a decade ago, and they seem to be very bad still. Can you tell us a little bit about Turkey's relations with Israel and with other powers in the area?
Well, you're right. In the 1990s, I think 1990s were the golden years for Turkey-Israel partnership. Turkey signed, and ironically, under another Islamist prime minister, Turkey signed many defense agreements with Israel. But at the time, in the 1990s, Turkish military, which always promoted closer ties to Israel, used called the shots in the 1990s. Now, in today's Turkey, that's not the case anymore. And this government, President Erdogan, really used the Palestinian cause to shape his image, to boost his image in the region as well as domestically. Domestically, despite the close ties with Turkish government and Israel over the years, if you listen to the people of the country, Palestinian cause has always been a sensitive issue. Turkish people always supported the Palestinian cause. And President Erdogan, he came to power and he used that, of course, because of his Islamist background as well, as a rallying tool. And that really worked. after the 2009 incident, for instance, when President Erdogan attacked Israel in Davos. He received a hero's welcome, not only in Istanbul, but in the region. That was became a major boost to his image. People started naming their children after Erdogan after that incident. So he has been using that anti-Israel rhetoric to mobilize support, both at home and regionally. But of course, that further strains Turkey's ties with the United States. But despite that, the rhetoric, if you look at the trade relationship between the two countries, it's going fine. So I think the two countries managed to compartmentalize to a certain degree their relationship. And in terms of Turkey's relationship with other actors in the region, I think the most important incident in 2018 was Turkey-Saudi relationship. Turkey was the actor, the vocal critic of the murder of the journalist, Washington Post journalist Khashoggi. And that strained Turkey's ties with the Saudis. And the relationship had already been strained over Turkey's support for the Muslim Brotherhood. And this incident also affected Turkey's relations with other Gulf countries except for Qatar. So Turkey has, I think that Turkey has found, particularly after the Arab uprising, Turkey has found itself increasingly marginalized in the region. So if you look at Turkey's relationships in its neighborhood today, it's on different fronts with Iran. Obviously, Turkey-Syria relationship is quite troubled. If you look at Turkey's relationship with Iran, Turkey has problems there. And with the Gulf countries, with Egypt also, Turkey criticized the coup in 2013 that toppled the Muslim Brotherhood government there. And since then, relations have been strained. So Turkey has become a marginalized actor, to sum up, after the Arab uprising.
That's an excellent, excellent summary.
We're out of time. That was the voice of Dr. Gurnaltol, the founding director of the Middle East Institute's Center for Turkish Studies. She's also a former professor and has taught courses on Islamist movements in Western Europe, on Turkey, world politics, and the Middle East. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The French government will take new measures to deter violence against police and damage to property as it seeks to corral the Yellow Vest movement after another weekend of mass protest. More than 50,000 people demonstrated over the weekend, with some of the marches turning violent. The Macron government is taking full advantage of the opportunity to clamp down on dissent. We're joined by Gilbert Mercier. He is editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post and the author of The Orwellian Empire. Welcome back, Gilbert.
Thank you, Father. Me, you guys.
Gilbert, these demonstrations over the weekend were huge, but not quite as huge as they were when they began in November. Still, they turned violent, and there's actually very widely viewed YouTube video of a French professional boxer beating up a policeman.
Correct, John. There were actually three main events last weekend. Number one, it was not 57 people. The Ministry of Interior has been underreporting, and the media, they've been underreporting the numbers of protests, okay? That's number one. Number two, there were three main events. As you mentioned, a former professional boxer by the name of Christophe Détinger, who is becoming sort of a folk hero among the Gilets Jaunes since that event, took Beran on CRS, on riot police, after his wife and a friend of his wife were sprayed by pepper spray, okay? And he turned himself in a day later, but there was one more thing, in complete contrast. A commander of gendarmerie beat a couple of Gilets Jaunes protesters in Toulouse, okay? And also, not least, a few people grabbed a forklift and broke a very solid door of a French minister and start breaking the cars of the government spokesman. Okay, so the thing is, okay, as you mentioned, that they're trying the Edouard Philippe and his associate Christopher Castaner are playing tough guy, and they're trying to kill the dissent. Okay, they announced yesterday on TF1. The main TV channel, Edouard Philippe announced that there would be 80,000 cops and riot police for Act 9. However, the Gilets Jaunes will be there. And it's not tightening the screw. You see, those people like Edouard Philippe, who fancy himself also as an amateur boxer at some point in his life, they're sort of like what's called in the U.S. chicken hawks. You know, it's sort of all talk. And I'll tell you, the striking image of that guy, the boxer who's 6'4", and of course, a professional fighter, taking on, CRS with shields, helmet, and everything, it was kind of almost a vision of the movie Gladiator with Russell Crowe. And it's, you see, they keep trying to target. The last time I was on the show, we were talking about Eric Drouet. Well, Eric Drouet is kind of on the sideline. So now they're targeting this guy, okay? But there will be more. It's not going to be just one. There will be 10. There might be even 100. See, that's the problem for the Macron administration.
The other thing, Gilbert, that you shared with us last week, and I think this is really, really important, because the protesters are being characterized as violent. But you said last week, 11 of the yellow vests are dead, mm-hmm. and scores or hundreds are wounded.
That's right.
So when the state uses violence, when the state actually uses violence such that people are badly wounded or even killed, that's called law and order. But if people fight back, if people resist, then they're violent.
And this boxer had to turn himself in. He turned himself in just a few hours ago. Gilbert is right. He's becoming a folk hero because he took some action. And I think the government is going to make him more of a folk hero because they are going to prosecute him now. Gilbert, I want to ask you, too, these new measures that are being taken. Today, the French government outlawed, for example, the wearing of masks. What else is the government trying to do to crack down on these demonstrations?
Look, I want to go back to what happened after the terrorist attack of November 13, 2015, 4 years ago. For 2 years, under the Hollande administration, there were an état d'urgence, a state of emergency, and they put on the book, and it's still on the book, legally, they can arrest people preventively in France, and they've been doing that. France is, to some extent, a police state, and that has to be spelled out. Now, for 2 years, French people were numb. They didn't react. Now, they are reacting. And like any people that have, and I mentioned that in the very first time we talked about this on your show, people that have an history, a culture of revolution, of insurrection, like the French, like the Russian, like the Cuban, like Haitian, okay, mainly Haitian, actually. Once you push people to the limit, okay, they are not going to lay down. They are not going to do like the Occupy folks here who let themselves get plastic handcuffed. You know, they will do something. And that's precisely what they're doing. Action provoke reaction. I think that realistically, those people that govern France are very bright people. Okay, they're very well educated, but they should study their own history a little closer. And I'm talking about what General de Gaulle did in 1969. And General de Gaulle was a great soldier, of course, and a great president. In 1969, after the episode of May 68 protest, he put together a referendum, and that's still in the book in France. The president can decree a referendum. He lost, and that was the April 27, 1969, to be precise. The next day, he left power. No, that is class. Macron, whoever, who, by the way, never served in the military, doesn't have that class. But he think they can act like, little tough guys. Okay, realistically, the option for Macron. What first thing? dissolve the Assemblée nationale or call on a referendum. That's basically going to be the only option. That's my projection, at least.
Do you see that happening? Do you see elections on the horizon?
I think there's going to be two steps. I think the crackdown is not working, okay? What they can put together is around 150,000, all combined, cops, gendarmes, and military, okay? They cannot recall the Foreign Legion because they're busy doing a little business of colonial upkeeping in Africa. So who are they going to call? Okay, are they going to shoot their own Frenchman instead of doing that with rubber bullet? Are they going to use real gun? It's very unlikely. They're going to have to cave in. They choose the wrong approach. What they should have done to defuse the situation is put back the tax on the very rich, the ISF, and make promise the Gilets Jaunes to do what they're asking, which is the referendum of citizen initiative. They didn't do any of that.
Gilbert Mercier is our guest. Going back to the events of May 1968, Gilbert, the students started the protest, then the workers joined it in a general strike. France was engulfed in massive protest and resistance. De Gaulle actually left the country for a while to try to regroup. While that near revolution didn't become a revolution, or maybe it wasn't really a near revolution, but it had a lot of the hallmarks of a real countrywide crisis, things did change in France. There were reforms. I mean, in many ways, France made major steps and steps forward, especially in regard to education and elsewhere. Here we have, again, the French tradition of in the streets, in struggle. And it's against, as you declared it, and you said it right, France in some ways is the hallmark of a police state. I mean, when the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia began March 24th, 1999, that's 20 years ago in 2 months, the French government banned all protests right away after the first militant protest. Anyway, 1 minute left. Gilbert, you take us out.
Exactly. But I would like to conclude here on something that is completely appropriate, which is a quote from Aldous Huxley, the British writer of Brave New World, that was published in 1931. And that applied to France and most of the world, actually. He wrote, "The perfect dictator would have the appearance of a democracy, but would be basically a prison without rules. It would essentially be a system of slavery where through consumption and entertainment, the slaves would love their servitude." And this was written 88 years ago. And unfortunately, it was sort of prescient. So it was previous to the fascist rise in Europe.
On that piece of wisdom, we're going to have to close it out. We were joined by Gilbert Mercier. Gilbert is the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post, and he's the author of The Orwellian Empire. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.